We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Today, chocolate is a $50 billion global industry. But when the trade began, it was controlled by just a few families. And this morning, in this hour of the show, we'll explore some of that history and the history of some of these families, one of them in particular, the Cadburys. And our guest for the program is Deborah Cadbury. She is a writer. She's a documentary producer for the BBC. She's authored a number of books, including one that we will talk about this morning. The title of her book is Chocolate Wars, the 150-year rivalry between the world's greatest chocolate makers. Public Affairs Books is the publisher. And it's a book that, among other things, takes a look at how the chocolate trade influenced the food industry and also how the values of the Cadbury family influenced the trade. She's talking with us this morning from London. She's on the phone. We're pleased to have her as guest. And as we talk, questions from people who are listening are welcome. We hope that people will be on target with the topic and we'll try to keep their questions brief. But questions are welcome. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. Toll-free 800-222-9455. That's the one to use if it would be a long-distance call. And if you'd like to send us an email, you can do that as well. The address is will-talk, W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. At any point here, you're welcome to join the conversation. And Ms. Cadbury, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Hi.
And I do want to stress here that your interest in the subject, you do indeed come by it honestly, because you are, in fact, a member of the Cadbury family.
That's right. The story I grew up with was that going back five generations, there were two brothers. So we're talking about, you know, the early 1800s. Benjamin made pearl buttons and ran a draper's shop, and his younger brother John was just one of the first into the chocolate business, and he was making chocolate buttons and ran a tea and cocoa shop. And to my huge disappointment, I learned from an early age that I came from the pearl buttons, not the chocolate buttons. But 50 years on, that, you know, that puts me in a unique position, because as a historian, a huge number of family records came my way. But at the same time, I'm not writing about my immediate family, the chocolate branch of distant cousins, so I could keep my editorial independence and write the story exactly as I felt it should be written.
Mm-hmm. And do I have this right? Do I remember, though, that you did have the experience as a girl of being able to tour the factory?
Oh, such a memory. My uncle actually did work in the business. When I was about five, he and my father took me and my sisters round the chocolate factory. And truly, it was like entering, you know, the Willy Wonka book had not been written then, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. But to my eyes, that's exactly what it was like. You know, there were great vats of chocolate all around you, you know, chocolate being whisked on conveyors above your head through holes in the wall to, you know, distant spaces beyond. And the smell, absolutely overpowering. So, you know, it was a very, you know, it's kind of experience you don't forget.
Yeah. You know, part of the story here that I think that it's really interesting is the, and kind of complicated, is the story of how it is that people figured out how to get from the raw product, from cocoa, to the thing that we would now recognize as being a chocolate bar. That initially they knew they had this thing, they had this raw commodity, and people apparently felt there was something they could do with it, but they weren't really sure what.
It really wasn't obvious. I mean, if you go back to when John Cadbury was running his little cocoa shop in the 1820s in the Midlands, in an industrial area here, all the big names like Forrest Mars of Mars Bar fame, Rudolf Lindt, Milton Hershey, none of these people were born yet. So the entrepreneurs that were going to really shape the business just weren't around. And at the time, it was very, very hard to separate out the fatty bits, the cocoa butter, from the rest of the bean. So So the Victorian manufacturers who were bravely venturing into a cocoa business were really turning out what they thought was a sort of nourishing and wholesome soup, and very often to mop up the fats, things like lentils or pearl barley or molasses was added, and it was a very sort of thick, rich mixture, which we would probably find dreadful today. But for the Victorians, you know, it was like a real novelty. And it really took a generation in the Cadbury family before they, you know, suddenly there was this breakthrough in terms of separating out the fats from the rest of the bean and thinking in terms of a confectionery product and a much purer cocoa. But it really wasn't obvious when they started.
And I guess gather that one of the things that the Cadburys early on had acquired a reputation for was a product that was pure, because if you got chocolate, drinking chocolate at that point, or you went out and you bought this item that you were going to consume, there was no telling what might be in it.
Oh, there were unscrupulous manufacturers who were adding things like brick dust or even poisons like vermilion or red lead, or very often animal fats were added. So, you know, there could be drops of fat on top of your cocoa and it could go rancid. Obviously not the Cadburys, but, you know, other manufacturers were doing this. And cocoa really had a very mixed reputation to start with. It wasn't remotely like what you can go to the supermarket and buy today.
So another interesting facet of the story is that the Cadburys and the other two families that were very big in the chocolate business in Britain that were contemporaries, the Roundtrees and the Fries, mm-hmm. were all Quakers, and mm-hmm. that when they started out with this small business, the Cadburys, one of the things that they were interested in being Quakers was promoting alternatives to alcohol, and they thought perhaps chocolate, drinking chocolate, would be a good alternative.
Yes. They really believed that they were going to be providing a sort of wholesome food product to, you know, the impoverished industrial masses who were really suffering in Britain at that time, you know, appalling squalor in the industrial slums. You know, they were teetotal. They were very strongly teetotal, campaigning against drink because the gin palaces of the time had sort of taken over. You know, many poor people's lives were really ruined by drink. So it's very interesting looking back in the family scrapbooks just how seriously, you know, Quaker values, trying to do good in the community, trying to help their fellow men right from the earliest days. There are some really heartrending stories. And what intrigued me, because I started to, you know, research this in detail during the credit crunch, and I suppose what motivated me was I was sort of watching in disbelief as one bank after another was collapsing, you know, these famous names, fueled often by reckless speculation and greed. And it seemed such an incredibly long way away from the stories my father had told me as a child about, you know, Quaker values in business. And I really felt strongly something was missing, and I suddenly felt, you know, really hungry to go back and work out how on earth did they create such a successful business when religion was their guide, mm-hmm. You know, and the very heavy responsibilities they put on themselves as owners. And what was amazing was going into the archives, the Quaker archives, there was an entire set of codes, really from the British Civil War, on how a Quaker should conduct himself in trade that was really trying to apply the Bible to business. And I think the Quakers must have been one of the first groups to do this. And what caught my eye was that they were astonishingly successful. People started to trust Quaker traders. And many famous names today, you know, like Barclays in the Bank, Lloyd's, Backhouse Gurney Pease, Darby's Iron, Kay's Shoes, Clark's Shoes, Huntley and Palmer, Cadbury's Chocolate, all of these were Quaker firms. And so, and it was such a big and successful movement, I thought it needed a name in its own right. I called it Quaker capitalism to define what they were trying to do.
Mm. And that's, it really is striking that, and it again, it connects back to their belief system, their religious beliefs. For Quakers, there were certain things that they, in terms of careers, that they couldn't do. They were not going to go into the military. They were not going to government. So going into business was really one of the few options that was open to them.
Yeah, they were really forced back on their own resources because as Quakers and like all the nonconformists, they couldn't have they couldn't hold establishment positions. But I think the interesting thing is that they worked out a set of values that seems terribly touching today. You know, Joseph Rowntree, you mentioned the Rowntrees, he wrote, "The real goal for an employer was to seek to secure for others the fullest life of which an individual is capable." And they really believed that, you know, it was their responsibility to use the business from its earliest days to try to help everyone involved, what today we would call all the stakeholders. So the workforce, the local community, and wider society were all to directly benefit from the business. It wasn't that you got rich and then you became a philanthropist. The whole business model was to try to help everyone involved. And coming back to that story of John Cadbury and, you know, struggling with his starchy cocoa, by the time his sons took over the business, George and Richard in the 1860s, it was actually still a loss-making business. But they figured out that wonderful thing of, you know, separating the bean and coming up with a chocolate product and a pure cocoa. And when they became successful, they then started to, you know, as soon as they started to make profit, they were starting to really radicalize how they ran the business. And it culminated in building a model community to transform the lives of their workforce.
And they were really the first ones that made chocolates in the way that we would recognize them. I think that they were the first to make an assortment of small chocolates and put it in a fancy little box and that kind of thing that we would all recognize now as a box of chocolates.
Yeah, it did make me smile, actually, because as Quakers, you know, the senses were on no account to be indulged in any way. You know, the path to God was through plainness, austerity. The idea that, you know, greed in any way should be indulged, totally alien. And yet these fancy boxes, as they were called, the first chocolate assortments, were, you know, the ultimate in sensual pleasure. And the descriptions of them, because, you know, milk chocolate didn't exist then, it was plain chocolate. And they were obviously so rich and sumptuous and, you know, almond marzipan and strawberries and truffle and these wonderful flavors. And the boxes themselves were made to last. They weren't like today's sweet wrapper throwaway. They afterwards would be ladies' embroidery cases or glove boxes or tissue holders or photograph holders. And they were just a very, very beautiful thing, these fancy boxes. So, you know, it was lovely to see, I suppose, the first stage in the conflict with Quaker values as they finally got the business going.
Our guest in this hour of Focus, let me just introduce for anyone who might have tuned in, is Deborah Cadbury. She's a writer. She's an award-winning documentary producer for the BBC. She's the author of a number of books, including Chocolate Wars, which is a history of the chocolate business, looking particularly at some of the big makers, including the big British companies, and Cadbury is certainly one of them. She also does write in the book some about the Lindt people in Switzerland and Milton Hershey here in the United States, who also were in the same business. It's quite an interesting story, as social history, as business history. If you're interested in food, I think that you would find interesting things here as she talks about how it is that the candy that we come now to know got developed and some of the technical issues that had to be resolved. It's all in the book Chocolate Wars, published by Public Affairs. Questions welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Something else here that I think is interesting, and again, it goes back to some of the technical issues here. It was, and I believe that it was Rudolf Lindt in Switzerland who was the first person to develop a process to make chocolate a very smooth thing, again, sort of as the way we would recognize it. And then one of his rivals was the guy who figured out how you could add milk, which was actually very difficult, again, because there's water in the milk, there's fat in the cocoa. Those two things don't want to go together, but he somehow figured out a way to do that.
Yes, the Swiss, the Quaker firms in England were the first, really, to turn the starchy cocoa drink into, you know, realizing that you can have a chocolate business and a a much purer cocoa. But then the Swiss really did the next stage, which was working out how to make that chocolate experience so, you know, wonderfully delectable. Because Rudolf Lindt developed, and the story is it was a happy accident, that he was a bit of a gentleman entrepreneur and he liked his weekend off and accidentally left his factory with his machine running, beating the cocoa beans. And when he came back, far from being ruined, it was a wonderful creamy texture, really sort of soft and melt in the mouth. And that's when he devised a special technical kit called conching, which allowed him to beat and aerate the cocoa beans for much, much longer. And that led to the melt-in-the-mouth chocolate experience. And at the same time, a rival managed to crack the problem, and it took him 20 years of combining milk with chocolate in a bar for eating, effectively mimicking, you know, the milk chocolate drink, but in a bar. And that caught on too. That was very successful. So then the English manufacturers were very quick to catch up. And by the 1900s as well, Milton Hershey in America, seeing the way chocolate had just taken off, because what happened was that in the late 19th century, being in chocolate was suddenly a bit like being in mobile phones in the 1980s. It went from a product which no one could afford to a product which was on every household weekly shopping list. And Milton Hershey, who was then known as the King of Caramel and had finally got some successful business going, thought, no, I'm going to sell my business and just gamble everything on chocolate and sell it from coast to coast. So suddenly the Americans sort of woke up and smelt the chocolate. And, you know, the whole chocolate wars was really intensifying.
Yeah. It's also interesting, we were talking a little bit earlier about the big companies, the Cadbury's, the Fry's, and the Roundtree's. They were Quakers.
Yes.
Milton Hershey was, his mother was a Mennonite.
Yes. Milton Hershey was meant to be, as I understand it, he was terrifically influenced by the Quaker chocolatiers in England, because when George Cadbury created Bourneville, which was the factory in a garden and the model community that he created outside of Birmingham and outside of those smoky, foggy, grimy slums. You know, he really created this fantastic utopian, you know, sort of dream village. And what he was the first to, you know, start to introduce things like sickness benefit, unemployment benefit, pensions. It developed to workers' cottages and this whole model community, free doctors and dentists by 1900, vitamin pills for staff who were unwell. By today's standards, it seems very paternalistic, but at the time, when there was no legal protection and no workers' rights, people were queuing up to work at Cadbury. It expanded to, you know, they were putting everything back into the community. So there were hospitals, there were schools, there was free education for people that couldn't read or write. He created a very aspirational community. And Milton Hershey read all about this. In fact, it's highly likely he even visited Bourneville and was totally inspired and thought he could do exactly the same. You know, the influence of his Mennonite mother and his entrepreneurial father sort of came together in the creating of the wonderful Hershey model community.
We have a caller here. We would welcome other people into the conversation as we talk some more with Deborah Cadbury. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. You can send us an email also at will-talk@illinois.edu. We have a call. Well, no, I guess they changed their mind. Other people, though, if you want to give us a call, you certainly may do that, and we'd be very happy to take questions. As you have explained, the Cadburys were very interested in trying to incorporate their religious values into the way that they did business. So hence their feelings about investing in their workers and paying back into the community and so forth. One of the things that's interesting here is that, again, because of their religious values, at least early on, they didn't believe in advertising.
Yeah, amazing. Joseph Rowntree especially was very against it. You know, he thought that if the product was honest and good, it would sell itself. And advertising was seen as slightly shabby, dishonest, unprincipled exercise. You know, he dismissed it as mere puffery. And the Fries were the same. They would write these very dignified letters to local tradesmen if they had a new product and relied on word of mouth to sell the product. So it's such a contrast to today when the chocolate firms can be amongst the biggest advertisers. And one really successful or brilliantly run chocolate campaign can really transform decades of consumer loyalty. But then it was a very different story. And as Quakers, they were very much against advertising.
Was there some particular point where they made a significant change in their attitude, or was that something that was more gradual?
This was very gradual. It was really as new entrepreneurs came on the scene, like Forrest Mars, who came up with his Mars bar in the 1930s and sold 1 million in the first year. And it was a new concept, the idea that you don't go for a solid block of chocolate. This was really the next, you know, great massive expansion of the chocolate trade. After the Swiss had come up with milk chocolate, Forrest Mars comes along and sees that he can, in those hungry 1930s, massively reduce the price point by mixing chocolate with cheaper ingredients like nougat or caramel. And he came up with the Mars bar, which was filling and satisfying, and you got more for your money than you would with a solid block of chocolate, and rapidly came up with a successful business. So, you know, the Quaker firms had to think on their feet, come up with other count lines, as they're known in the trade, that are combining cheaper ingredients with chocolate. And this whole notion of mass-produced confectionery really began to take off. And by the 1960s, with television, that's when it just became very intense.
Yeah, that's really, again, it's interesting that the various people involved in here and what each of them brought to the business. And
each one of them, yeah. Each one of those famous names behind the bars you see today, each one of them was really responsible for a breakthrough in our development of chocolate to what it is today.
And Forrest Mars was this guy that he, you know, now the thing we think of as being a candy bar, this combination of elements, was his idea. And so that's
really
why we have Milky Way and Snickers and stuff.
But not really on a factory scale. He really launched that massively with the Milky Way, actually in Chicago it started, his father and Forrest Mars together in the 1920s. And then when they fell out, because it seemed to be quite a troubled relationship, he then went to Europe with the patent to Milky Way and came up with the Mars bar, which was very similar ingredients, and turned things around on two continents. So really some entrepreneur there.
And that was just the idea was that you could have these less expensive ingredients and you could essentially make the block out of these other things, but then you put a little bit of chocolate on the outside, and so you have a product that has a complicated appeal, has all these different elements, but the most expensive thing would have been the chocolate, and there would have been the least amount of chocolate in there, so you could sell it a lot more cheaply.
Yeah, that's right.
You talked a little bit about Bourneville. This was the village that Cadbury's built for their workers. And again, it goes back to the idea that they really had this strong belief that it would be wrong for them to benefit exclusively from all the money that the company was generating. They had this idea that there was something that just accumulating all this wealth or accumulating a lot of debt was just wrong. They really believed that was really wrong, and that it should be plowed back plowed back into the community. And they really had this strong commitment to their workers, and so they built this village, which apparently Bourneville is still. It's still extant. You can go there and see, or at least see some of the housing that was part of Bourneville. Talk some more about how Bourneville came about and what it was like.
Well, it's very evocative because the pictures survive of those earliest days of Bourneville. George Cadbury was, I suppose he believed that no child should live where a rose couldn't grow, was the story that went around. He really felt that the slums were harming and stunting the growth of children and, you know, the growth of people in the health and lives of people in caught in these industrial slums. And Quaker research really does highlight just how horrific it was. You know, there were people making chains for things like a penny an hour, or sweated labor in the tailoring trades and other things. Just appalling. You couldn't possibly hope to feed your family on the kind of wages they were getting. And industrial injuries were common. And, you know, looking into the family albums, it's very clear that the Quaker sense of responsibility about what you should be doing in the community counted for far more than the business. One of the stories that caught my eye was that John Cadbury campaigned long and hard about the use of climbing boys. And what happened was that boys in the workhouse, which is where you went if you fell into debt or were really poor, boys in the workhouse as young as five were being taken by chimney sweeps and used to clean the chimneys in Birmingham. And to induce these poor boys to climb up the chimneys, they would light fires underneath or even poke them with pins to make them climb. And many of these boys were getting appalling injuries. And the chimney sweeps wouldn't reform their habits. And John spent a lot of time campaigning for this practice of climbing boys to be, wiped out, made illegal. And there's lots of amazing social history like that that just shows you desperately hard times that people endured then. So that was the background in which Bourneville came into being. And George Cadbury really believed that your own soul lives or perishes according to its use of the gift of life, and wanted to do something to help people. So they bought the land at auction 4 miles south of Birmingham, and 15 acres, a sort of buttercup meadow with a trout stream across it, and started to build the factory. And they hadn't got much money, so things were done on a very tight budget. But right from the start, they were trying to improve the lives of the staff. So there were incredibly beautiful grounds provided for the women to walk in. And to this day, the pictures survive of the women in their, you know, long factory dresses at the time, playing croquet or reclining by the lily pond or doing things that you just wouldn't expect women factory workers to be doing. But you just get a sense of the idealism behind the whole venture, men playing cricket or having lectures in Roman history, all sorts of things like this. So, you know, it was a very idealistic, romantic vision. The houses were planted up, the gardens were planted with fruit trees, so there would be a vista of blossom for these families when they looked out across their gardens to the next gardens. And everything was done to bring people close to nature. It was a terrifically romantic ideal,
and
but it just grew from there.
And some of these houses are still there?
Oh, yes, it's all still there.
It's all still there. That's what I had thought, that it was still there.
Bourneville is still there. It's now run by the Bourneville Trust, which is still owned by, run by Cadbury family members. So Kraft bought the factory, but they didn't buy Bourneville Village itself.
This morning in this part of Focus, we're talking about the history of chocolate and the chocolate industry and how it is we get from the raw cocoa product to the thing that we now recognize as a palatable chocolate. It's the story that you will get if you look at Chocolate Wars by our guest Deborah Cadbury. We'll have more after a short break. This is Focus.
Programs on WILL are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting the community to the return of Outside at the Research Park on Friday, July 8th at 7:30 p.m., featuring Del Castillo. More information is available at krannertcenter.com.
It's the biggest intelligence breach in U.S. history, the leaking of more than 500,000 classified documents on the WikiLeaks website. Bradley E. Manning, an Army intelligence analyst, is charged with handing them over. Who is he? What does this story tell us about how and why the secret cache of documents may have been leaked? You tune in tonight for a program on the Frontline series. That's on our companion station, WILL-TV. Wiki Secrets is the program and explores all this territory. So that's tonight at 8 on WILL-TV. In the second hour of our program today, we'll talk about current events in Syria with Joshua Landis. He is a professor of Middle Eastern Studies at University of Oklahoma. Tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, the guest is Francis Fukuyama. He is a senior fellow at Stanford University. We'll talk about his recent book, The Origins of Political Order, from pre-human times to the French Revolution. We are here weekday mornings with 10 different interviews for you. If you'd like to check up on the schedule, see what we'll be doing in the days ahead, or listen to past programs, go to our website. It's WILL.illinois.edu. In this hour of Focus, we're talking with Deborah Cadbury. She's a journalist, an award-winning documentary producer for the BBC, and is author of the book Chocolate Wars. The subtitle is The 150-Year Rivalry Between the World's Greatest Chocolate Makers, which is in part a history of the Cadburys, and she is one of the Cadburys, as she explained at the beginning of the program, that she doesn't descend directly from the chocolate Cadburys, but she is indeed a Cadbury, a member of that family. The book is published by Public Affairs. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have a caller here at where we are, Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi, good morning. I'd like for you to... It seems like it's sort of an internal to England sort of story you're telling, but there's a couple of strands that I thought maybe you might have something to say about. Is you mentioned that there was this mission to bring the luxury good to the masses. I've heard a story about how when cocoa first came to the European continent, it was kept as an elite thing, and it was the sort of the Basque traders that brought it, and that might be beyond the purview of your study, but I'm wondering whether the humanity of the Quakers extended to, you know, it's obviously it's a tropical food. It was originated in the New World, but it was mainly grown, I guess, in Africa. Conditions right now are not very good for the people that are harvesting cacao in West Africa, and I'm just wondering whether it's too much to expect the Quakers, a very progressive sort of movement, to have been in any way anti-colonial, anti-exploitation in those terms at that time. What do you think?
Well, this is actually a big chunk of the story that we hadn't gotten to yet, but where I was going to next.
Mm-hmm. Well, firstly, you're completely right. It was the Spanish that brought chocolate from the New World. Their conquistadors brought it back. It went into the Spanish court first and made its way from there across Europe, where the British really were the first to start to apply industrial techniques to food production, which was a really revolutionary thing to do. But moving on to the slavery, I think there's a really interesting issue here, which highlights the difference between the Quaker capitalists of the 19th century and early 20th century and what happens in today's system of international global shareholder capitalism. Because with the Quaker firms, they had, you know, just created their utopia that I described, and Cadbury's created Bourneville, and Roundtree's created a utopian village in York, when at the turn of the century there were reports of slavery from a Portuguese colony, Sao Tome, where they were buying their beans. And, of course, Quakers had been instrumental in getting rid of slavery in the first place, so they were horrified to think that their beans may be coming from a place where slavery was still in existence. And what happened, I think, is a very interesting example of how Quaker capitalism worked that's different to today's markets, because the Quaker firms immediately united. Roundtree, Fry, and Cadbury were rivals, but they united to try to solve this problem. They appointed investigators to really try to get to the bottom of the problem in the field. When they'd got the evidence, they then went to the Portuguese authorities and the British Foreign Office to try to sort out the problem. And when that failed, they did a boycott of the beans and introduced their own methods in Ghana. So the equivalent today would be if Nestle, Hershey, Mars, and Kraft united to tackle the horrendous problems that you alluded to of child trafficking, especially on the Ivory Coast. So I think the really interesting thing is that the Quaker method acknowledged that there are some problems capitalism can't solve, that the free markets have got enormous strengths and we've all benefited, but it's not good at sorting out injustices in trade and labor. And as you rightly say, you know, if anything, this problem is worse than in Victorian times, because at the top of the tree in, you know, many food businesses, the managing directors will be on something like $20 million a year, where at the bottom of the pile in West Africa, the grower might be getting $2 a week. If you're child trafficked labor, nothing at all. So it's a very serious problem.
Hmm. I can give the caller a quick chance for follow-up if he wants.
I just take issue that the free market has actually existed for any long time, but that's another discussion that we could have at another time, I guess. But, I'm glad you take the point that the conditions actually are probably in some way worse, and that corporate elites who just look at the quarterly return are much worse than these inspired entrepreneurs of an earlier day, I would guess. Thank you.
I'm curious because now there is a lot of attention focused on the spread between what CEOs make and what your average line workers make in a lot of companies. I'm just curious, do you know what the spread was between the Cadburys and the workers in terms of how much they made? I'm assuming that the Cadburys were made more money than the people who worked in the factory did.
Yes, they did. And what happened really across the 19th century was that Quaker families sort of went one of three ways. There were some Quaker banking families, especially, that made stupendous amounts of money, and it became very hard for children to adhere to the values of their elders, and they just ended up leaving, drifting away from the Quaker movement altogether. And then there were others, like the Fries, that tended to stick rigidly to Quaker values and Quaker plainness and, you know, all those, you know, wonderful, stern Christian edicts. And they tended not to move with the times and tended not to modernize, and gradually the businesses fell away. And then there were others like the Cadburys that I suppose you could describe as worldly Quakers that thought, yes, it's okay for the entrepreneurs to make some money, but yes, they also lift the whole community as well. So it was sort of a compromise solution. But you see, I think there's very interesting issues raised by this story as you come to the end, to the modern incarnation, after four generations of Cadbury brothers. Because while I was writing the story, I thought I'd just finished when it was announced that Kraft wanted to make a bid for Cadbury. And, of course, within the Cadbury family, there was, you know, great alarm at this. It was very distressing. And what would happen to those Quaker values? And I think what's really interesting is to highlight one or two things that totally sort of illustrate the difference between what I'm talking about, the Quaker capitalism that these people try to introduce, and today's system. Because, and I suppose what I'd like to single out is the hedge funds, because during the bidding process, when Kraft bid for Cadbury, at the start, hedge funds only owned 5% of Cadbury, but by the end of that virtual bidding process, they owned 31%. And the point about this is that the hedge funds were very happy to sell for 20p. So effectively, you know, people who didn't own the company a few weeks earlier and had no intention of owning the company a few weeks later were happy to sell this 200-year-old company that in its day had been an icon of good practice for 20p. And I think this really illustrates the changing notion of ownership as we've gone global. Because the shareholder is meant to be the owner of the business, but they're not acting as the owner of the business in the sense of that joined-up responsibility for the grower, for the consumer, for the quality of the product. You know, they're now really interested and obliged to deliver short-term returns. So I thought there was a really interesting issue there about the pressures on management as markets have gone global, and it's very much shown up by this process.
Mm. We just have about 10 minutes left in this hour of focus with Deborah Cadbury, author of the book Chocolate Wars, published by Public Affairs. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's a question. I'm not sure if you can answer this, but someone has been listening to the conversation and feels that, and obviously your focus here is on particularly on British companies, but also by European and American manufacturers, feels that maybe we're not giving enough credit to the indigenous people of the Americas. This is, after all, where chocolate came from. And he says he believes that Mexican chocolate is quite good, And I guess want some acknowledgement of the fact that, yes, this is where it came from. The Europeans wouldn't have had it to play with if they hadn't gotten it from
it
here.
It was a New World product. And, you know, for centuries, it had been drunk first by the Olmecs and then by the Incas and the Aztecs. And it was, a terribly important commodity in their societies, usually taken with chili rather than sugar. So it was a very spicy drink. And cocoa pods were incredibly prized. In Aztec culture, it was actually used as money and coinage, and the lower orders would pay the emperor with cocoa pods and great trunks of cocoa pods. Mm. So it was a very prized commodity. And I think it's interesting how it's done the full circle, really, from the Americas to Europe, and now is back in the hands of America. Because I think, coming back to this craft takeover, what intrigues me is the scale of our modern businesses. And Kraft is the second largest food company in the world, with 100,000 employees generating $40 billion of business. And it has mopped up, three of the great names from the British early confectionery companies that once ruled the world, like Terry's, Cadbury and Fry. And its big rival is Nestlé, which is the world's largest food company, with 500 factories making literally a billion products a day. And it's mopped up Cadbury's rivals, Roundtree and Macintosh. And I think it's really interesting, how these businesses have become truly huge, truly global. But yes, the chocolate is back in the hands of the Americans. Mm.
And just to go back to the point that the caller made as well, and it is true that when chocolate was introduced into Europe and initially when people were drinking it, this was something that it was not a product that would be available to the masses. It was very expensive,
very
and only wealthy people initially would be able to have it.
It was very much the Quaker firms, and there are wonderful accounts, really, of Fry's, who first started to come up with sort of mass-produced chocolate products. And what they did was they were whipping up sugar into a creamy consistency and cutting it into sticks and coating it in chocolate. So they made, like, chocolate-coated sticks. And they're frock-coated travelers, if you can imagine, because that's what they were, with top hats and wonderful long coats, were going around with their traveling bags with this amazing new product, which grocers and sweet shops had never seen anything like it, because it was the first factory-produced sort of chocolate sweet. That would have been in the 1850s, and it was really the first to sort of embrace the idea that you could make a mass-produced chocolate sweet, which I think is really cute to imagine.
Yeah. That must have, for those people, one could only imagine the first taste for those people who had for whom this would be completely new.
Oh, such sweet stories, too, because when the Cadburys first launched their pure cocoa, it was so unlike anything the Victorians had tasted, who were used to cocoa with all sorts of questionable extras, that the first shopkeepers' reports, apparently they screwed up their faces as though they tasted woodworm and thought it was very bitter and really didn't like it at all. It took a little while before these more modern products caught on.
People, I think, may recall the controversy over on that side of the water when the plan was announced that Cadbury was going to be taken over by Kraft. Mm-hmm. And here we have a big Kraft plant in our town, so we have feelings about, I'm sure people here have feelings about Kraft. Mm-hmm. So people there in Britain, I know we're very unhappy about this and felt mm-hmm. that would not be good for the product. They were concerned about what the quality of Cadbury candy mm-hmm. would be and so forth. Can one say at this point what the acquisition of Cadbury by Kraft has meant for the company?
Well, it's too early, really, to say where this is going or what Kraft is going to be doing with Cadbury. Obviously, there was outrage here because Roundtree, which was Cadbury's big rival, had already fallen to Nestlé in the 1980s, and Cadbury was such an icon, really, of those days, you know, such a symbol of pioneering a different way of working, that it was really a much-loved firm. And when Kraft bought it, you know, the idea of, I hate to say it, but a sort of a faceless conglomerate buying this firm that really had built up a very strong relationship, you know, around Britain with its consumers, it did provoke absolute outrage. But at this stage, what you see is really the effects of globalization, because control of the company has now moved to a different continent. You know, the control is either in Zurich or in Chicago, whereas it had always been at Bourneville. So, you know, the workforce were very used to seeing the management, and certainly when it was family management, you saw the managers all the time. They were always around. They knew everybody. They were just there in the community. Obviously, there's an anxiety for staff. They're in danger of becoming a mere commodity, swelling the red column in some balance sheet on another continent. No longer that wonderful relationship where the staff were buying into a whole aspirational community where they felt the owners, in a very sort of steward-like and paternalistic way, were looking after them. You know, it's worries over jobs. And that sort of fabric that brought unity to a community and a sense of belonging, there's real anxiety that that will no longer be there and what's going to be in its place. So I think there are real concerns as to where this is going to go, you know, whether the spirit of the company will stay the same.
Well, you know, just to make this much more confusing, one of my colleagues, he knew that I was going to be doing this show today, so he stopped off and bought some candy, and he came in and plunked down a Cadbury bar in front of me here and thought, I guess his idea was that I should be eating Cadbury chocolate while I was talking to you. But the thing that I think is curious here, so we have this, it's a Cadbury, it's a dark chocolate bar, and what's curious is you turn it over and it says that it actually was manufactured by Hershey under license from Cadbury UK.
Oh, yes. Cadbury never managed to get into the American market. There were two or three attempts, and they also tried to link up with Hershey, too, because Hershey very much was seen as the ideal American partner in that they had the model community, they shared the values. At one stage in the 1980s, when they had an unsuccessful venture into America, Hershey bought the rights to quite a large number of products. It was a very unsuccessful attempt, and there were huge debts to settle, and Hershey bought the rights to some of the products at that time. So that may explain, I don't know which bar you have in front of you, but that may explain why it has a Hershey license.
It's Cadbury Royal Dark Chocolate is what it says.
Right.
And it says it was manufactured by the Hershey Company. So, well, I guess that again just tells you that the production of this item is, aside from the fact now we have a lot of boutique manufacturers,
yes,
and people are interested in chocolate the way,
yes,
they're interested in wine, because different,
yes,
chocolate grown in different places has, they say,
yes,
has different qualities, and people, I think, are interested in chocolate where the cocoa content is about as high as you can possibly, has as much,
yes,
cocoa as you can possibly get into it. People are really interested in all that, but still, that it's obviously it's a mass produced product, and it's in a made by a couple of very, very big international companies.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
So how, yes, just I'm just curious about, you know, was sort of little thing when back in the day the Cadburys were very concerned about the welfare of their workers, and they made this model village for them, and they were trying to make sure that working conditions were very good, and I'm sure that these people were not particularly wealthy. They were probably pretty well paid for the time. How did the Cadburys prevent the people who worked in the factory from eating the product?
Well, right from the early days, I see that there were some marvelous incentives, and you got like a penny reward, which in those days was a lot, for every day that you didn't eat chocolate, so that at the end of 3 months, you could use your rewards to actually buy something fantastic. So there were all sorts of bonus schemes if you managed not to eat the chocolate. But I reckon if I'd been there, I would have been gulping back the chocolate. And I'm sure a lot of the workers were, because, you know, it was irresistible stuff. And a lot of these people would have been very hungry. Different days, totally. It's fun to imagine what it was like.
Yeah, I suppose the alternative would be that you, working around it, you might actually get to the point where the last thing that you would want to do is to have chocolate. But
well, I don't
not.
Know. When I was writing the book, I had a stack of all the different types of chocolate from all the rival firms lined up under my desk. And I was quite happy to sample fair bits every day.
Well, and I remember a couple of weeks ago, we struck up a conversation about this in the office in the area where our staff is, and someone said, fine, you've done it. I now have to go downstairs to the candy machine to get a candy bar because we were standing around talking about chocolate. So even talking about it was too much for her. We'd broken her entirely, and she had to go get herself a candy bar.
Yeah.
Well,
I understand that.
It's a really interesting story on all these various levels. As I said, if you're interested in social history, in business history, I think to me the parts that are interesting also are these the aspects of the – because cooking really is chemistry and what it is they had to do to be able to figure out how to get from the raw product to this nice chocolate bar, which we now recognize today. So there's an awful lot in this, and it hasn't destroyed your interest in chocolate.
Oh, no. and what's lovely, actually, is if you eat those very dark chocolates, a certain amount every day is actually beneficial. It's stuffed full of antioxidants. So so long as you're not gulping back masses of the sugar-filled chocolates and the cheaper chocolates, the really dark chocolates remain to this day really good for you. So I thought it was nice to know that.
All right. Deborah Cadbury is our guest. The book is Chocolate Wars, published by Public Affairs. Ms. Cadbury, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.